and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the big moment in last night's Republican presidential debate when Senator Marco Rubio parried Governor Jeb Bush's attack on his former protege, quoting an editorial in Florida's Sun Sentinel calling for Rubio's resignation from the Senate because of his record low attendance and voting record. Rosemary O'Hara, the editorial page editor of the Sun Sentinel, who was a director of the Association of Opinion Journalists and a four-time juror of the Pulitzer Prizes, who wrote the editorial, Marco Rubio Should Resign, Not Rip Us Off, joins us to discuss her state's aggressively ambitious absentee senator. Then we'll look into a tale of two retirements. A new study from the Center for Effective Government and the Institute for Policy Studies that finds 100 of America's CEOs have as much in retirement assets as 41% of America's families. The authors of the study, Scott Klinger and Sarah Anderson, join us to discuss the inequality gap where David Novak, the CEO of Yum Brands, has a retirement nest egg of $234 million, while hundreds of thousands of Yum employees at Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and KFC have no company retirement assets whatsoever. Then finally, we'll speak with Lisa Gilbert, the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch, who is a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics. She joins us to discuss the ideological riders that will be attached to the new budget bill that will not just defund Planned Parenthood, but undo EPA protection, stop the SEC from having corporations disclose their political spending, block rules mandating rest period for truckers, and prevent the FCC from enforcing new net neutrality rules, among many other poison pills slipped in unless the public raises its voice to stop these sweetheart backroom dirty deals. And joining us now is Rosemary O'Hara, who is the editorial page editor of Florida's The Sun Sentinel, who previously worked for the Miami Herald, Cincinnati Inquirer, and the Tampa Tribune, also as editorial page editor. She is a director of the Association of Opinion Journalists, a four-time juror of the Pulitzer Prizes, and her latest op-ed at The Sun Sentinel is Marco Rubio Should Resign, Not Rip Us Off. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rosemary O'Hara.
Hi, it's nice to be here, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, Rosemary. And you weren't mentioned by name, but your work was in last night's Republican presidential debate. And it was probably the most dramatic moment. It's certainly the one that has gotten the most press and the most punditry, if you will. So let's get some background on these two, Governor Jeb Bush and Senator Rubio. I understand that it used to be a sort of mentor-protege relationship, but based upon what happened last night, that relationship has clearly soured.
Well, the stakes are so high. The gloves are off. They had talked about having a campaign where they could be cordial and joyful and respectful of one another. I think they both might hope that's still the case because there is a friendship that goes back to when Governor Jeb Bush was governor of Florida and Marco Rubio was in our state legislature. Marco became the Speaker of the Florida House when Jeb was governor, and so they had a pretty good working relationship. Jeb was always the adult in the room. Marco was more the upstart, you know, young, handsome representative who, you know, wanted to do some things. But it was really Jeb who was always driving the bus.
Well, but the question, that one of the questions that were asked of Senator Rubio basically implied that he's just ruthlessly ambitious and just treats political positions as a springboard to the next political position. Is that a fair description of his political resume so far?
Well, it's, everything is more complex than we can, well, you know, just on the surface. When he was in the Florida House, the nature of politics, probably in California as well, is that he immediately began running to be Speaker of the House. I can't say that he had a terribly distinguished record as a lawmaker here. When he became, he ran in a three-way race to be one of our two senators from Florida, and, you know, and won in the three-way race. And when he got, and convinced a lot of us, including the Sun Sentinel, and we endorsed him for the Senate, that he wanted to go to Washington and make a difference and was going to fight for us and, you know, show what could be done. And once he got there, it seemed like he almost immediately began running for president. He wrote a book that was sort of forecast as, you know, introducing himself to the nation. He was responsible for one big piece of legislation on immigration reform, but he pretty quickly dialed that back in the face of opposition. And then since then, you know, we haven't seen a whole lot of him in Florida. He's been really busy introducing himself to the nation, but those of us who have some issues we would like to see him address in Washington, it's a little difficult to get his ear.
Well, in your editorial in the Sun Sentinel that you wrote, Rosemary O'Hara, that was quoted last night, I think both by the questioners and by Governor Jeb Bush, you start out by saying, after 5 years in the United States Senate, Marco Rubio does not like his job. A longtime friend told the Washington Post he hates it. Rubio says hate might be too strong a word, but he sure acts like he hates his job. That's pretty extraordinary, that you hate a job which has often been referred to, the U.S. Senate, has often been referred to as the best club in the world.
It is, and the opportunity to make change happen in a deliberative way is extraordinary in that most powerful chamber in, you know, our nation's government. But he's frustrated and has made it pretty clear that he doesn't like the pace. Nobody likes the dysfunction that's happening up there. But, you know, he wants out. He doesn't like it, and so he pretty quickly has, you know, decided to pursue a different job where he thinks he can make change happen on a faster pace. I think one of the questions voters have to consider is if he found his job in the Senate so frustrating that he didn't feel he could get things done and so he wanted out, why won't history repeat itself were he to win the White House?
Well, there certainly aren't any jobs above that, are there?
Unless he wants to be Pope.
Right. Well, he's a Mormon. I think he might have a hard time with that, right?
No, I don't think he's Mormon. I think he is Catholic.
I know he was born Catholic, but I understand he converted to Mormonism. But
You know what? Then you know something I don't know.
Well, tell me, though, how is this sitting with Floridians, the idea that you elect a senator to do the people's business, and he doesn't like the job? That strikes me as being, you know, almost insulting, or if not petulant, you know?
Yes, and when did it become okay in politics for somebody who doesn't like his job to basically, you know, and wants another job to just start running for higher office and not do the job he's elected to? You know, why other people have done it, and that's his point. He made that point in the debate last night. Yes, Obama did it. Yes, Kerry did it. Although I was surprised to see him, you know, comparing himself to Obama and Kerry, like, you know, he's right in there with him. But, you know, but there is this, you know, in politics as usual, as we know it, there seems to be this thing that says it's okay not to do your job when you're running for higher office. Well, it's not okay. And, you know, so we called that out, and he takes exception to that. And when his, you know, competitors call it out, he takes exception to that. So who gets to call it out, you know, when somebody isn't doing his job? He wants to turn around and rather than address it, or rather than do his job, he wants to blame the media.
And again, I'm speaking with Rosemary O'Hara, who is the editorial page editor of Florida's Sun Sentinel, who previously worked for the Miami Herald, Cincinnati Inquirer, and the Tampa Tribune, also as editorial page editor. She is a director of the Association of Opinion Journalists, a four-time juror of the Pulitzer Prizes, and her latest op-ed at the Sun Sentinel is Marco Rubio Should Resign, Not Rip Us Off. So what's the local reaction then to your editorial, because obviously you're tapping into something that's there, that this is, you know, I'm sure you're not the first person who's raised this issue. In fact, I think,
right.
Didn't Governor Bush raise this issue a little while back?
That Yes, Governor Bush has raised it on the campaign trail. The national media has been bringing it up. And then, you know, it made the debate last night. I think people, you know, there's a certain cynical nature to our politics, and people just think that, you know, this is the way it is. And I think the reaction depends on what lenses you see the world through. You know, if you're in Florida, we have actually four people from Florida who are running. We've got Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, you know, lives in Palm Beach, and Ben Carson lives in our area. And so, and they each are creating their audiences and their teams. And so it depends on, you know, the lens you saw this through, how your reaction is. A lot of people have called or emailed or written letters to the editor to say, you know, yeah, right on, you go. And then, you know, I have people who have said things to me that I couldn't repeat on the radio.
So is Donald Trump and Ben Carson, are they your readers? Aren't you in the Palm Beach area?
We are, our reach is Broward County, which is Fort Lauderdale, and South Palm Beach County. So yes, you know, there's another newspaper north of us, the Palm Beach Post, that is more in West Palm Beach area, which is where they live. But we're definitely one of their hometown newspapers, yes.
Well, you certainly got a national plug last night.
Well, you know, sometimes it's interesting that newspapers, and we have our challenges, you know, especially in the digital age. But editorial pages have historically stood up for their communities, you know, and tried to connect the dots and tell people, you know, what's beyond the news. Here's what we think. And it's not that we expect everybody to agree with us, but, you know, here's what we think and why we think it. And maybe, you know, consider this and maybe you'll agree or not, but you'll know how we think about it. And I think that is the job of a editorial board and editorial page of a newspaper, is to stand up and stand up for our citizens and stand up for our community and call out bad behavior when we see it, pat people on the back when we see it, you know. And we have been, we got accused of being extremely biased, but I'll tell you that we endorsed Marco Rubio for the Senate when he was running. And in the last presidential election, we endorsed Mitt Romney because of our disappointment with, you know, the hope and change that didn't happen, you know, that we were promised. So we and people react, you know. I mean, there's always on these kinds of issues, you know, and races in politics, it's personal and people respond, you know, often from a personal level. But And sometimes they wonder, why do you do this? But we do try to be play the role of championing, you know, good government and open government. And let's talk about this. Let's convene the conversation around the issues that we face.
Well, just to clarify the religious affiliation of Marco Rubio, he was born Catholic. He did switch to Mormonism, but then he did switch back to Catholicism. So.
Oh, okay.
So that's his ecumenical history there.
So still a candidate for Pope then.
that's right. You got it. So in your editorial, you say, and it's obviously addressed to your senator, Marco Rubio, you are paid $174,000 per year to represent us, to fight for us, to solve our problems. Plus, you take a $10,000 federal subsidy, declined by some in the Senate, to participate in one of the Obamacare health plans, though you are a big critic of Obamacare. You are ripping us off, Senator. Those are fighting words. I mean, have you heard back from him?
No, we haven't. You know, but I, you know, we heard what he said last night in the debate. And that is how we feel, you know. I mean, we only have two senators, like every other state, and we have one Democrat and one Republican, and we expect them to be up there on the job. And, you know, if he doesn't like it, or if he really wants to be president, go for it. Go full steam ahead for it. But resign your position, because there's still more than a year until, you know, whoever is the next president is actually, you know, given the oath. And so between now and then, we're not going to have a senator working full time for us, and he's going to be collecting the pay. I mean, you know, resign the seat. Let us have a full time senator. Give it your all. But, it, you know, it's unlikely to happen, because he wants the paycheck. He wants the prestige. He wants the people around him that the office gives him. But the honorable thing to do, if you really want to leave and you want this other job, go for it. But don't leave us with an empty seat for more than a year.
Well, just on the point that you just made, Rosemary O'Hara, in your editorial, you say, and it is unconscionable that when it comes to intelligence matters, including briefings on the Iran nuclear deal, you said, quoting, "We have a staffer that's assigned to intelligence who gets constant briefings." So he is using his Senate staff, clearly.
Can you believe that? You know, I mean, it's not just that he has the worst voting record in the Senate. He also is not attending these committee hearings, and he's not attending some number of these really critical intelligence briefings. You know, he's sending a staffer to intelligence briefings and then, you know, trying to catch up on the fly. Well, there's some real serious issues that are facing this nation on the world stage. And, you know, it is unconscionable to me that he's, you know, sending a staffer rather than being there himself and weighing in and, you know, doing what he told us he was going to do.
Well, when you said a little while back, Rosemary O'Hara, that Marco Rubio answered the questions last night in terms of the criticism that both Governor Bush leveled at him in the editorial that you wrote in the Sun Sentinel, which was quoted as leveled against him, but he didn't answer it. That was what was so interesting. He did a kind of jiu-jitsu move on Governor Bush, who attacked him, and then he turned around, neutralized the attack in a kind of martial arts way, I guess, in terms of rhetoric, and then proceeded not to answer anything except basically say that just because you're running against me, your aides are telling you, you know, to be critical. The same thing happened when he was asked questions about his tax plan. He denied the fact that it basically is weighed to give huge tax cuts to the ultra wealthy. He denied that. But in all of the fact checking that's been done today, it's pretty clear that the questions from CNBC were absolutely accurate.
Right. You know, it is a common card in the playbook that when you don't like the question, you know, you turn and you blame the media. Or in the case of, and it was really surprising to me that Governor Bush, who has not performed like the politician that we in Florida have known him to be, that, you know, Marco got his best line of the night in there, that exchange, because Jeb Bush was unable to really close the deal and you know, make the point. And so, yeah, no, the dodge and weave is to tough question, don't like it, you know, turn it back on whoever is your competitor, you're just trying to attack me, or the media is, you know, biased, and, you know, and not to be held accountable. You know, it's why people are so frustrated by our politics. It's so hard to get a straight answer.
Well, but the other line that he got a lot of applause for was, again, attacking the media, where he said that the Democratic Party, in effect, the mainstream media is a subsidiary of the Democratic Party. I'm not giving you the exact quote. What I found extraordinary was Rubio wasn't the only candidate up on the stage last night that attacked the press. Clearly, Senator Cruz did. But the idea that you're attacking these journalists from CNBC, which is a pretty, I think by and large, pretty conservative business orientated network, particularly when one of the questioners on the CNBC panel was Santilli, the guy that actually started the Tea Party movement. It was his apparent sort of outburst some time back that became viral, and most people attribute that as the sort of, you know, being the Paul Revere, if you will, of the Tea Party movement. So I found that the whole thing somewhat surreal, that they were attacking the liberal press when they were actually attacking, by and large, a very conservative news outlet, CNBC.
But then remember, you know, the first debate was hosted by Fox. And, that panel asked tough questions, and the response, again, was, you're the liberal media, or the media's to blame. So it didn't surprise me, because we've not only seen it as a regular go-to maneuver in this presidential campaign, but we've seen it in past campaigns too. So somebody doesn't want to take a question about their finances, or take a question about their, Newt Gingrich, his wife and his family values. And if they don't want to take a question, the reflex is to come back at whoever the questioner is. And it plays to the audience. You know, it was a friendly audience. And last night there was a big round of applause for that. And because a lot of people don't like the media, and how I feel about that, I can't tell you, being in the newspaper business, when something goes wrong, I can't tell you the number of people who call the newspaper and say, could you please have a reporter look into this, and so we don't get it right all the time, but we really do our best to try to, lay it out there. And do we have biases? Yes, we have biases, and we try to, control that, or, get not just both sides, but all sides. But in the world that we live in today, you can tell somebody's politics by what cable television station they listen to, it's distressing to those of us in the newspaper business that, we're seen as the enemy, in the discourse of our politics, when really we're trying to help people know what's going on so they can make an informed choice. And, it's how democracy works. And if a free press isn't here, how are people going to know? And so, those folks who are rooting for, the end of newspapers, and they just want to get their information from bloggers or from those who agree with them, be careful what you wish for.
Well, just in closing, it would seem, though, from my point of view as a journalist, I find it extremely depressing that people would side with politicians who want to avoid having their feet held to the fire, want to have softball questions, don't want to be answerable to the public, and that they would side with that kind of cynical dodge, as opposed to be on the side of the journalists who are their advocates for transparency and truth. Rosemary O'Hara, I thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate the conversation.
Well, it was nice to talk to you, Ian. Thank you, too.
And again, I've been speaking with Rosemary O'Hara, who's the editorial page editor of Florida's Sun Sentinel. She previously worked for the Miami Herald, Cincinnati Inquirer, and the Tampa Tribune, also as editorial page editor, and is the director of the Association of Opinion Journalists, a four-time juror of the Pulitzer Prizes. And her latest op-ed at the Sun Sentinel is Marco Rubio Should Resign, Not Rip Us Off. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into A Tale of Two Retirements, where 100 of America's top CEOs have as much in retirement assets as 41% of American families.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
What have we done?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Scott Klinger and Sarah Anderson. Scott Klinger is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. And Sarah Anderson directs the Global Economy Project, the Institute for Policy Studies, and is a lead author on 20 annual executive excess reports and serves on the investment subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. She is a co-author of the Institute's 20th anniversary executive excess report, Bailed Out, Booted and Busted, and her books include Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. They have just released a new study at the Center for Effective Government and the Institute for Policy Studies, A Tale of Two Retirements. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger and Sarah Anderson.
Thank you.
And Scott, let me begin with you. The takeaway here that got my attention is that 100 CEOs in the United States have the same amount in their company's retirement accounts as 41% of America's family have collectively in theirs. So that's a pretty startling and disgraceful statistic.
Yeah, so the reason we did this report is because we think that most Americans are aware there's a retirement crisis in the country. And we think that the dominant story is that the problem is that people aren't saving enough. It's a problem of personal responsibility. And we think the real story is that we have a set of rules that prioritize self-interest over common good. And so we decided to look and see how the people who help set the rules, the CEOs of companies, are doing in their pension funds and their deferred compensation plans relative to the average American worker. And we knew we'd find a bad story, but we didn't know we'd find it to be this troubling. One of the things we saw is that there's a real incentive for companies to reduce the amount of money they spend on their workers' retirement security, because when they do, it boosts their short-term profits, and ultimately it boosts the CEO's pay. But we think that's a problem both for workers and ultimately long-term for companies, because we're going to have a bunch of retirees with not much disposable income to spend on things that companies make.
So, Sarah Anderson, is there a direct connection there between the defunding of employees' pension funds and the boosting of the CEO's pension funds?
Yes, we believe there is an intersection here, that there are these perverse incentives, as Scott mentioned, for CEOs to slash spending on all kinds of things, but including retirement benefits for their workers, because the company might get a short-term bump in their profits and the value of their stock. And the connection to the CEO's personal interest is that most executive compensation these days is in some form of stock-based pay. And so they slash costs, it bumps up the stock price, and that just means more money in the CEO's pocket.
And more money in his retirement fund.
Exactly. And one reason why the CEO retirement funds have grown so much is because CEO pay has grown so much, and they're dumping a lot of their compensation into these special tax-deferred compensation accounts that are set up by their employers, just for the handful of top executives. And there's a huge double standard here, and this is another thing we really want to get across with this report, that these executives can put unlimited amounts of their pay every year in these special tax-deferred accounts, where the money can grow and grow and grow until they retire and start withdrawing that money, and then they make a one-time tax payment on it. Meanwhile, ordinary workers who are lucky enough to have a 401k or some other kind of tax-deferred account, we face strict limits on how much we can put every year in those accounts. For most workers now, it's only $18,000. So, again, it's another rule that really privileges people at the very top who are the least in need of this kind of help for their golden years.
So, Scott Klinger, the example that you give in your new study, which reveals 100 CEOs have as much in retirement assets as 41% of American families, A Tale of Two Retirements. You mentioned here David Novak of Yum Brands. He has the largest retirement nest egg of $234 million, yet hundreds of thousands of Yum employees at Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and Kentucky Fried Chicken have no company retirement assets whatsoever?
That's right. Yum has about 500,000, a little more than 500,000 employees globally. They're one of the companies that doesn't declare how many of those employees are in the U.S., but we know that there's thousands of, you know, of their restaurants, so we know the number is quite large. They do have to make public every year their report to the Department of Labor about any of their pension funds, including their 401k. And in that, in their most recent one for 2014, they said that fewer than 9,000 of their employees had any money in the Yum Brands 401k. So here's some, and I think he had about half again as much as he had. He himself had 50% as much as the total employees had in their pension funds, something like that, 50 or 60%.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who's the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. And Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project, the Institute for Policy Studies, and is the lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports. She also serves on the Investment Subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economics, and is the author of Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. Both Scott and Sarah have just released a new study at the Center for Effective Government and the Institute for Policy Studies, A Tale of Two Retirements. So, Sarah, just back to the change that's been underway for some time, where it used to be that pensions were defined and secure. And then I guess the Congress, I don't know how long ago, a decade and a half or maybe longer ago, changed the rules, basically throwing most workers' pensions at the mercy of the stock market through 501ks. So walk us through that change and the results of that fundamental shift in defined benefits.
Yeah, so there are basically two ways of having retirement funds. One is the defined benefit traditional pension, although we shouldn't even call it traditional anymore because they're so scarce. They've really gone the way of the typewriter in the American workplace. That's the kind of pension plan that guarantees a monthly check after you retire until you die. And that used to be the typical way that workers, especially at big companies, would get their retirement money through their employer. But there's been a huge shift really starting in the 80s, the Reagan era, when many companies scrapped those kinds of pension plans in favor of 401ks, which really put workers at the mercy of volatile financial markets. These are tax-deferred accounts, so you can set aside, you decide how much money you want to set aside up to certain limits every year from your paycheck, pre-tax. So there is that advantage to it, but it is invested in the market with no guarantee, as there was under these previous kinds of plans, that you will get a guaranteed amount of money until you die. If you make the wrong investment choices, that money can really disappear. So the companies, by doing this, shifted the market risk onto the employees, and that is one reason why we have such high levels of retirement and security in this country. And I should say that only about half of American workers have access to even that kind of plan. Even, you know, it's a much less generous, less secure type of plan than used to be the norm. And even, you know, with those kinds of plans, only about half of American workers have them.
Well, that might explain why I believe up to two-thirds of recipients of Social Security depend upon that Social Security check as their only form of retirement benefit. Is that your understanding, Scott?
That's right, and the average check is less than $1,300 a month, so imagine trying to live on that when that's all you have.
So, of course, Social Security came up a number of times in last night's Republican debate with people like Governor Christie of New Jersey thundering away that it's all a fraud, it's all a hoax. Huckabee did come to the defense of Social Security as much as saying that, you know, the people who paid into the account should not be blamed. It's not their fault. And the assumption amongst all of them on that stage last night, all of the Republicans, was that Social Security is a hoax and it's bankrupt. As far as I know, that's complete nonsense. So are there any fact checkers anymore? I mean, what goes on here? Because I was just astounded by the way they were beating the hell out of Social Security and kept repeating this lie over and over again with such confidence.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. It is a myth that it's on the verge of bankruptcy and, you know, people my age will, you know, not get a dime out of the system. That's very much overblown. And it's overblown because it fits in with this ideological approach of wanting to slash government spending and, you know, to balance the budget, cut the deficit, and all of that. It feeds into that whole line. And the other myth that absolutely drives us insane is this argument that we should just lift the retirement age and go up to 70 or beyond, which a number of the Republican candidates are in favor of. And they'll say that we might as well do that because people are living longer. And one CEO of BlackRock even said that, you know, why can't people work longer? They're just sitting around these days anyway. You know, we all have desk jobs. We're just sitting around. Why can't we do that until we're elderly? And it's just another reflection of how out of touch people are, that they don't know that, yes, overall life expectancy is increasing, but not for poor people or people of color as much as for white people in this country. And believe it or not, there are still some jobs being done in this country that aren't just about sitting at your computer. There is still really hard and dangerous labor being done that is critical work and is very difficult to do as you get on in years. So I think one thing this report is about is just showing what, the two tails of retirement, that you have some people who are so insulated, so privileged with, you know, more money put away for retirement than they will ever be able to spend, and just how detached they are from the experiences of ordinary Americans.
I would just add that, you know, I think the way this gets positioned is we can't afford it anymore. We can't afford for people to have a dignified retirement with Social Security. But it's interesting, those people never ask about why are we affording then these huge subsidies to subsidize executive retirement plans. So when a company is paying out $100 million in pension to its CEO, it gets to deduct every penny of that from their taxes, which is, if it's $100 billion, they're saving $35 million on their taxes, 35%. Why should the regular taxpayers subsidize that? How can the people that are arguing that we can't afford Social Security say that we can afford these huge CEO pay subsidies and retirement subsidies?
Well, the person who most of the pundits say lost the debate badly last night, Jeb Bush, was the only person who said anything sensible about Social Security. He did mention the fact that wealthy recipients of Social Security pay the same amount as the poorest, and that it's not a big deal to change the rules a little bit and to lift the caps, as Bernie Sanders and others have been arguing for the longest time, and that would ensure and put to rest this persistent myths that Social Security is going broke. But the other thing that came up specifically in connection to what we're talking about here in terms of A Tale of Two Retirements, your new study, was a question to Carly Fiorina about what kind of retirement could there possibly be for the new Uber economy, where people who are working freelance in several jobs, where they're so-called independent contractors, so they get no benefits whatsoever. And her response was, well, you know, the last thing you want to do is get the government involved in this, and that the private sector will take care of it. Well, it's the private sector who came up with this wonderful idea of the Uber economy, isn't it?
Absolutely. And when people say things like that, I think those people just must not know anyone who's in a position of having an elderly family member who cannot afford the the very high cost of care for elderly and people in this country. Because if they did, they would see the kind of strain that puts on family members who are juggling full-time jobs on top of taking care of people in their family. The typical caregiver these days is a full-time worker, a woman about 49 years old. Many of them are in the sandwich generation where they're both taking care of children and taking care of elderly. And what is that going to be doing for our economy in the long run? I mean, Scott already mentioned that seniors are also consumers. And so what does it mean to have our seniors just having to scrape to get by? What does it also mean to have so many people in the workforce stretch so thin as they're trying to juggle all of these huge responsibilities? And we need to take bold action to avoid this kind of a long-term care crisis. And we're hoping that with this report we might open some eyes to that need.
Well, Scott, not only are you talking about a tale of two retirements, are we living in a tale of two universes here between the Carly Fiorinas of the world who get these massive golden parachutes for being a manifest failure as the CEO of HP, and here she is telling everybody that the government shouldn't have any role in ensuring that the new workforce, if this is the way it's going to end up with the Uber economy, there has to be a reason why Wall Street has thrown so much money at Uber, where its valuation is about up, went from $40 billion to $60 billion. So there is something going on there that this looks like every Wall Streeter's favorite economic model for employment, and people just have absolutely no security whatsoever. I just find that breathtaking.
Yeah, well, there's one of the things we looked at in this report was the long history. We went back to the Second World War, even before, and looked at pensions. And the more there were government rules to protect retirees, the better off they were. The decline in traditional pension plans really happened at the same time as the decline in labor unions, and it started after Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic controllers union. And then there's been a, you know, what, 30-35 year war on organized labor. And if you tracked the decline of union membership, you'd see a pretty similar pattern for the decline in retirement security. So we don't need less rules, the Uber economy. We need more rules and more more core standards in what employers owe their employees in terms of a return for the service that they provide the company and the profits that they help the companies earn. I did want to make one more comment on Carly Fiorina, which was interesting because Hewlett-Packard is one of the nation's largest government contractors, and that's something else we looked at in the report, where we found 15 government contractors among the Fortune 500 CEOs who have much higher retirement checks when they retire than President Obama will. So we're giving these companies huge, lucrative, very profitable contracts, and they're just turning it in and putting it in the CEO's pockets, both now in current salary and later in retirement benefits.
So what's your sense then of where the some justice is going to come in here? Because I've you know, you hear these statistics, and there's no question about their accuracy, that, for example, one family, the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, I think there's about six of them, apparently they control more wealth than the bottom 40% of all American households. And believe it or not, the income inequality issue was very much on display on the Republican debate last night, except they acknowledge its existence, but their prescriptions, of course, will exacerbate the gap between the rich and the poor. So it's I just wonder where you think justice is going to emerge here in both the workplace and in terms of retirement.
Well, one thing that's interesting is if you look at the opinion polls about Social Security, it is extremely popular, and huge percentages of the American population do not want any changes in Social Security whatsoever. And so I think Republicans at their peril talk about raising the retirement age and making other cuts. But it's interesting to see that that's still the position that many of them are taking. I think as far as where it's going, our report lays out a number of ways that we can narrow this retirement divide. I mean, I think there is no way around strengthening Social Security, and that's something that was almost politically, suicidal to talk about about a few years ago, but is now gaining more and more attention as Senators Warren and Sanders and others are really pushing for that and combating the myth that you brought up earlier that there's just no money there to do that. There's also some, I would say, easier lift changes that we identify in the report that have to do with fixing the loopholes that really privilege the corporate executives, the double standard that I mentioned earlier, where the executives get to put unlimited amounts of pay into these tax-deferred accounts, whereas ordinary workers have these strict limits. These are the kinds of things that it should just be no-brainers to get rid of. With that one, it did pass the Senate several years ago and then died on the House side, but we do think that there should be some momentum around fixes like that are at least partial steps towards narrowing this divide and really ensuring that all seniors can live in dignity.
Just in the last minute, Scott, leave us with some positive ideas here, because this report is making me very angry and very disgusted, and I'm sure our audience feels that way. And also, they'd like to get hold of the report. So go ahead.
So we think that there's a shift happening in America right now. People are aware that the rules are rigged against them, that things need to change, and they tend to go one of two ways. They either go, it's the government's fault, and they become, very bitter and cynical and drop out or want to attack the government or shut it down, or they go the other way and think that, boy, what we really need here are policies that prioritize all of our good, the common good. And, so I think that's what this election is about. It's about the people, the populists in the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders has been there for a long time. Hillary's moved more in that direction than she has been. And then we have the cynics on the Republican side. And so we think our job is to tell people it can be different. It has been different. This report tells the story of really sound government policies decades ago that gave our parents and grandparents much more secure pensions than many of us will have.
And the report, where do they get that?
You can either go to Sarah's website, which is ips-dc.org, or ours, which is 4foreffectivegov.org.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who's the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a Security Analyst and Portfolio Manager for Walden Asset Management. And Sarah Anderson directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is the lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports. She also serves on the Investment Subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy and is the author of Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. They both have just released a new study at the Center for Effective Government and the Institute for Policy Studies, A Tale of Two Retirements. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the ideological riders that will be attached to the new budget bill.
It's the money.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding axes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lisa Gilbert, who's the Director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Gilbert.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the budget deal that Rand Paul was complaining about in last night's Republican presidential debate, and I believe he's prepared to filibuster it. I think that Senate's going to be in session till 1 a.m. tonight. In terms of of what you're concerned about these ideological policy riders that have been added to the budget bill. The House bill's been voted out. Is it a clean bill or is it laden with all of these poison pills?
It's a great question. I think one of the pieces of confusion around this debate is that there are actually two pieces of budget legislation that have to pass. So what they're doing right now is voting on the framework. So how much money is actually in the budget and how they'll pay for it, what offsets will cover the costs of doing the great thing that they just did, which is end the sequester funding levels and raise the spending caps. And then after it passes through both the House and Senate, as you said, it just passed the House today, then all of the appropriators, the folks who are in the House and Senate who have to figure out where the money actually goes, which agencies and which programs it goes to, will turn to creating an omnibus package. That package is where we're concerned that the mischief will happen, that all of these ideological policy riders, things that can't pass through the system any other way, will get tacked on.
Well, let's just go through some of them. Prevent the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency from updating important air quality standards for ozone and roll back a recently finalized rule that protects clean water. Block a U.S. Department of Labor rule that would ensure Americans are getting sound financial advice on their retirement savings. Stop the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission from requiring publicly traded companies to disclose their political spending. Prevent the White House from requiring federal contractors to disclose their political spending. And cracking down on contractors that violate workplace laws, block rules that limit the number of hours truckers are permitted to work without an adequate rest break, despite safety concerns that truckers' fatigue causes serious accidents, and roll back strong net neutrality rules and prevent the U.S. Federal Communications Commission from enforcing rules that ensure internet openness and affordability. Now, just about everything on that list, these are results of massive political battles that the public and the consumers won, and yet they can, in the dead of night, they can put in these riders that basically kill them?
That's exactly right, and sadly, you've just named only a handful of the things that have been proposed as possible policy riders. Some of the biggest ticket things that people have heard about are the rider that would defund Planned Parenthood, but as you say, there are lots and lots of other priority issues that are on the list. So the way the process works is that each appropriations committee creates their bill, and their bill has the opportunity for mischief. So they can attach policies that have already been voted into legislation and try to strip funding from implementing them, or they can attach whole new pieces of legislation that haven't even passed through the process at all. So it's definitely the dead of night. It's definitely not okay with the American public, and we need to stop it.
But are they, because there are so many of these people on the so-called Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party side are against just about everything that government does, and this whole idea that this budget deal was a way to stop them from doing the most reckless thing of all, which would be creating a debt ceiling crisis, which would have terrible detrimental effects on the U.S. economy and on the dollar itself. That's been allayed. That's why everybody's praising Paul Ryan for stepping up and saving us. But it sounds so the same people that he's trying to keep at bay, they're being unleashed, aren't they?
Yes. So the debt limit, extending it is something that had to happen. It was not actually part of the budget deal. It was just voted on at the same time, but there was no kind of negotiation with the White House over it. That is something that we needed to make happen. It was essential. It needed to happen before November 3rd, and it is passed out of the House. And as you said, sometime tonight, post-filibuster, it'll pass out of the Senate. Separately, we have this two-part process around funding the government. They figured out the funding. That was the first part, and now they need to figure out where the money goes and keep all the bad riders off. So, it's stage two of the funding battle, and certainly the government could still be shut down if they don't come to a deal that works.
So when you mentioned the Planned Parenthood rider, we know that that's a red light for a veto from President Obama. Mm-hmm. Is that the only recourse we have? Or because my sense is that you can't name and shame these people. This is either it's ideologically driven, in the case with some of the so-called Freedom Caucus people, or it's simply they're all bought off by the Koch brothers and other interests who want to be able to pollute freely and don't want the government interfering with their profit margins.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly a veto threat over ideological riders is important. You've mentioned one that we are sure would cause that to happen, but there are many other things that we hope would also cause that to happen. We're hoping, though, that we don't get to that point, that we're just able to keep the budget deal clean. I think there's a lot of praise right now for both chambers actually governing and moving the budget framework, and they won't want to undo that goodwill by moving forward something that's not passable. So that's our leverage point. I think it's a good one. It's a high ground, and what we need to do as a progressive community is push to keep all of these riders off, the things that would undo our environmental protections, our financial protections, make it harder for the public to be protected.
So in terms of the lobbying groups that have arrayed around a clean bill and trying to keep these ideological riders from basically destroying the bill and allowing some of the most detrimental rules to pass and kill some. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've discussed net neutrality, and that was considered one of the great victories. And mm-hmm. the idea that they could roll back the gains on net neutrality in the middle of the night is just absolutely breathtaking. So Tell us about this coalition of 180 groups and how you expect them to sway this situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you mentioned net neutrality. We've talked about a lot of different policies that the public is for. I think that speaks to why so many, many organizations are working together to try to keep the budget clean, because if it's not, it impacts, there are so many different things at issue, whether it's net neutrality or women's health. And so, together, we sent a letter to the Obama administration and to those in Congress, but we're also pressing them directly, doing media, organizing all of our members to pressure Congress, and with 180 organizations, that represents millions of people. And I think, at the end of the day, we hope it works, that we get a clean budget.
Well, just tell us then what the timeline is here and how people can get involved and try and prevent this undoing of so much that's important to the lives of so many Americans.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the public can weigh in right now with the appropriators, so the heads of those subcommittees, as I mentioned. There's a petition that can be found at our public citizen website. Citizen.org is that site. Or folks, again, can call directly. I think that's the best way to let our legislators know as they are writing these funding bills that we're watching.
Well, but who exactly, how many chairs of how many appropriations committee, given that the Republicans control both houses, they must be pretty identifiable, aren't they? Can you name them?
They are. I can't name them off the top of my head. I'm sorry. But they are. There's about 10 committees in each, subcommittees in each chamber.
I see. So what's your sense then when we're going to know whether we're out of the woods and whether we get a clean budget?
Well, we see the omnibus funding package. People are throwing around lots of dates, but I think within a couple of weeks.
Within a couple of weeks. So,
yep.
So we've got 2 weeks to keep their feet to the fire. And
we do. Okay. We do.
I see. Well, Lisa Gilbert, I thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Gilbert, who's the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.